Shalom, and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, brought to you by the OU Israel Center in Jerusalem. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this week's show is for Shabbat Parshat Bo. Those of you who are regular listeners and or readers of Torah Tidbits know that Bo contains a very favorite mitzvah of mine, the one of the Jewish calendar. I'll try to go easy on the listeners, but we will definitely take another look, a different look, at that mitzvah, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodashim. A lot of other things to look at in Parshat Bo, but let's get down to our first order of business, as it is weekly, Tehillim Kuf Lamed Psalm 130. Shir HaMa'alot Mima'amakim Karaticha Adonai. Adonai Shema V'Koli Tehiyena Aznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai. Im avonot tishmoria Adonai mi ya'amod, ki imacha haslicha lama'an tivarei. Ki viti Adonai kivata nafshi velidvaro hocholti. Nafshi l'Adonai, mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara uvashivya, haomedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, hamakom yirachem aleihem, viyotziyem mitzara lirvacha umeafela laora umishibud lgeula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv, vinomar amen. Essentially, Torah Tidbits Audio is not a political show. I have from time to time commented on what's happening in Israel, which some people can say is political, but every time I've said it, I have felt justified in the context of a Torah-oriented show, because I don't believe any of politics is simply politics. It impacts on the life of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. So I'm going to make just a few different comments. They're a little disjointed, but obviously all about what happened yesterday and what's been happening and what unfortunately looks like it will continue to happen. First of all, the issue of illegal houses is one thing. And let's say, to make it simple, yes, the building is illegal, and yes, the court orders that it be dismantled or destroyed or torn down. There happened to be, according to a report from the then mayor, Ehud Olmert, something like 6,000 illegal homes in Jerusalem, in Arab neighborhoods built by Arabs, 6,000 illegal homes, which by law should also be taken care of. I don't know how to say it more than it is so obvious that this was a manipulation of different things in society that is definitely tied in to the elections, definitely tied in to the perception that Olmert, acting prime minister, wants people to have of the Kadima party. And from what I've heard from people who are not just bystanders, but people who are in the know, that the police yesterday were looking for blood, and they got blood on both sides. Even in milder situations, police have been known to use excessive force. And when you look at the news and you talk about, well, the teenage settlers started it and the police were just reacting, you can see that the police were out for blood. That image of a horse with a mounted policeman waving a baton, cracking skulls, and the statement that I heard from the senior advisor of the prime minister's office, was interviewed on English language Israel television yesterday evening, He says, what can we do? The Supreme Court made a decision. The law is the law, and we will uphold the law at all cost. When you hear that phrase, all cost, you have to wonder if cracking open skulls is what he had in mind, or killing people, is that what he had in mind? What does he mean by all costs? I want to leave that on the table. And then there's the report that the Yesha Council offered the government that they would actually move the supposedly illegal homes off the site into the town of Ofra, which is a legal place, and the government rejected it. I would suggest because they wouldn't be able to get their blood. And I say that in all seriousness, without hysteria, without joining the bandwagon. It was a vicious, brutal attack of Jew on fellow Jew. And do not tell me, yes, but they were violating the law. There are reactions, and there are reactions. And I believe the government and the police made the wrong reaction. Were the protesters looking for trouble? Probably. But that, to me, is not as serious as the official government, police, army, and how they react in these situations. F.E.A. Tom was criticized. He should be on the floor of the Knesset, not on the rooftop of an illegal settlement. Cute. Nice argument. But the question is, does that mean that a mounted policeman goes and cracks his skull open? One more point that really irked me on a different level was in the Post, the Jerusalem Post this morning. An animal rights group objected to the use of horses by the police because the horses might get injured. Interestingly, there was no report of any of the police horses getting injured, but the idea that that has to be a statement of an animal rights group, where the fact that anywhere from 70, 100 to 200 people, both police and protesters, were injured, some of them, many of them, hospitalized with serious injuries. But the animal rights group says it's unfair to use horses in a protest, in a response to a protest, because the horses might get injured. All right, I'm going to leave it at that for now. If something pushes me to say something more later, I'll do it. Otherwise, let's change gear. I think we'll use a nice song to do that, and then we'll get into Parshat Bo, and HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, and Bina'arenu Vizkeinenu Nelech, and Korban Pesach, and a lot of other things in the Parsha. But first, here's a song by Daniel Waldman from an album called B'makom Torah, or something like that. The song is Shiru Lo. The words come from Tehillim, chapter 33, verse 3, Tehillim Lamed Gimel Gimel. We say those words in that chapter on Shabbat morning as part of Psuke de Zimra of Shacharit. Daniel Waldman with Shiru Lo.
Eitivu, eitivu, nagein bisruo Shiru loy, shir chadosh, shiru loy, shir chadosh Eitivu, nagein bisruo Shiru loy, shir chadosh, shiru loy, shir chadosh Eitivu, nagein bisruo Shiru loy, shir chadosh, shiru loy, shir chadosh Eitivu, nagein bisruo Shiru loy, Shiru loy shechadosh, b'nei vel asor, asor, asor. chodosh eitivu, eitivu, nagen bizru. Shiru loy, shiru loy, shiru chodosh eitivu, eitivu, nagen bizru.
A very simplistic categorization of Torah would be to say that there are mitzvot in the Torah, commandments, laws, and there is agadata, stories, from which we learn many things, values, and other lessons of our history. From the beginning of the Torah in Bereshit, throughout the entire book of Bereshit, 12 weekly portions, and the first two weekly portions of the book of Shemot, we have had a total of 3 mitzvot. It is very fair to say that Bereshit and these first two sedras of Shemot were not essentially meant to teach us laws and mitzvot, although, as I mentioned, a couple of them are there, but it was there for the story, from creation through the flood to the patriarchs and matriarchs and the tribes, bringing us to Egypt and the experience there. And it is really first in Parshat Bo, this week's Torah reading, where we find mitzvot finally. There are 20 mitzvot out of the 613 that are counted from Parshat Bo, but they are not distinct from the storyline. They are part of the storyline, in contrast to other parts of the Torah, where we will find mitzvot really just listed without a context of a story. But that's not the case in Parshat Bo, and it's very significant. In fact, if we want to back up to the beginning, the 3 mitzvot that are contained in the book of Bereshit are all contextual mitzvot. I don't know if that's a real term or I made it up myself. Either way, I think you get the meaning. The first command of be fruitful and multiply comes to us in the context of the story of the creation of Adam and Eve, later repeated in the story of Noah and his family coming off of the ark after the flood. The command of circumcision is certainly contextual into the culmination, we'll say, of the life of Avraham Avinu and God's command that he walk before God in a whole way, with the words "Hitalech lefanai v'hayei tamim," it's possible to suggest that that is part and parcel of the mitzvah of actual circumcision. More details on that at some other time. The third one is the prohibition, the only prohibition in the book of Bereshit, on the eating of Gid HaNasheh, the sinew and its nerves in the hind quarter of an animal, and that is definitely contextual to the point where the Torah presents it to us by saying, after the story of Yaakov battling the guardian angel of Esav, that he was injured in the thigh and he limped, Al Kain, therefore, B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel, do not eat the Gid HaNasheh. And we are actually taught that the mitzvah prohibiting the eating of Gid HaNasheh could have been said and should be considered as if it would have been said, as in God spoke to Moshe, saying, speak to the people of Israel and tell them, thou shalt not eat the Gid HaNasheh. The fact that it came in the context of a story does not change the essence of the command, but it gives us an important perspective to understand God's rationale, so to speak, to prohibit that. But let's leave that for other times. That's all background. Now we come to bow, and not just one and another in the context of a whole book of Bereshit, but 20 mitzvot in this one single weekly Torah portion. And the first part of it really does not contain any mitzvot. The first two chapters, we're talking about the first 39 verses, are more or less like Va'era was in Shemot, story. And then we finally come to chapter 12, Perek Yud Bet, in, let's say, the second and third thirds of Parshat Bo, and that's where you have your 20 mitzvot. Basically, what I'm trying to say is that if a mitzvah often is presented to us pure and simple, thou shalt do this, thou shalt not do that, then when God chose to present us a mitzvah in the context of a story, then we're supposed to sit up and pay extra attention to learn not just the fulfillment of that mitzvah, but the context in which it was presented. And so we have the first of those mitzvot in Perek Yud Bet. God said to Moshe and Aharon Be'eretz Mitzrayim, when they were still in the land of Egypt, saying, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim, this month, Nisan, the month that you're going out of Egypt, is the first of your months, Rishon Hu Lachem L'Chodshei Hashana. And then it continues with the command of Korban Pesach, which we'll get to in a while. But the fact is, the Torah is telling us not just thou shalt set up a Jewish calendar based on the cycle of the moon going around the earth. It is telling us that this command was presented before the Exodus, and it was to Aharon and to Moshe still in the land of Egypt, and therefore we have to look at this mitzvah of the Jewish calendar with an extra pair of glasses, an extra magnifying glass. And certainly when you examine some of the details of this mitzvah of setting up the calendar, then it certainly speaks very significantly the context in which we find it. Here, I believe the Torah is saying, this is not a run-in-the-mill commandment. This is not even in that extra high category of a fundamental of Judaism. This is, as I called it in the written, printed version of Torah Tidbits, this is a prerequisite to nationhood. You, says God to the people, are, through Moshe and Aharon, are going to be a special nation, and you will receive the Torah, and you will have a totally new, different way of life to pursue. First and foremost, before we even get out of here, I want you to know that there is a concept of sanctity of time, and I, says God, practice that sanctity, and you will also practice that sanctification of time, which basically will define the kind of a nation you are. You are not a regular run-of-the-mill nation. And I have to go back to what I said in the beginning of the show, although it's very painful. If any other nation, democratic or whatever, has an attitude of the law is the law and at all cost you have to defend it, even if that involves cracking open heads, we are not supposed to be like that. I don't know how to say it any more than the Jewish people are supposed to be a nation unto itself, different and apart from all nations in the world. We have a different yardstick by which we judge ourselves, by which we are judged by God, and if you want to add, by which the rest of the world judges us, to me that's less important than the way we have to judge ourselves, and certainly the way God judges us. I didn't mean to lapse back into that, but it's extra upsetting when you hear government spokesmen talking about Israel, and he said it this morning, last night, the United States would do the same, England, Germany, Japan, of course, but Israel is supposed to be different. The Jewish nation is supposed to be different. In fact, we exist, we came into existence, and we continue to exist, and I believe we always will exist because we are supposed to be different, and because we are different. You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio for Parshat Bo. I neglected to tell you earlier that it is Thursday, Yom Chamishi, the 4th of Shvat, the 2nd of February, whereas in January, Tevet and January were in sync. In February, the Jewish calendar is 2 days ahead of the secular calendar, because the Jewish calendar month of Shvat has 30 days, and February has 28. We will lose that two-day advantage, and lo and behold, March and Adar will once again be in sync. This phenomenon can only happen across February with 28 days. In other words, the only time you can have a month in sync, skip a month and another month in sync, is January with Tevet, February with Shvat, not in sync, and Adar with March, in sync. You can, in different situations, have 2 months in a row that are in sync, but we're not discussing that. This January, Tevet, Adar, March, in sync phenomenon last occurred in 1930. So savor it for its trivia value, because that's about all it means. Now, just let me finish off on the thought I was just sharing with you. If you notice, I was using interchangeably, we are a different nation, we should be a different nation. And that's a very crucial pair of ideas. Because if we are truly the different nation we're supposed to be, good. But if we're only supposed to be different, but we're not, or we behave in such a way where we strive to be just like all the other nations, then we get into trouble, because then we lose our reason for existence. That's a very serious issue. I have a song now with a request. One request to God and one request to the listeners. The request to God is to hear this song. I've said this before, but it's especially important now, to hear this song as a prayer for Jewish unity and for peace and tranquility among the Jewish people. We could almost say we'll worry about Hamas and we'll worry about the Arabs and the Palestinians after we worry and pray for peace and tranquility among our own brothers. L'ma'an achai v'rei'ai, adabrana shalom bach. So that's the prayer. And the request to the listeners, I personally feel very agitated by what's been happening and agitated by the editorials that I've read and what I've heard from right-wing people as well as left-wing people. And the way that I've been talking about it at the beginning of the show and the comment that I just made a couple of moments ago is agitating. I want the listeners to join me in listening to this Lema'an Achai. It's not the Karlbach one. It's another track from that Daniel Waldman album. It's long, but I think it would be a good idea to close your eyes, to lean back or rest your head, and let the words of the song and the melody permeate and become your prayer to God for peace and tranquility within the Jewish world, within the Jewish community.
Oh,
I really hope that that song did something for you and did something for Klal Yisrael too, in the form of a very heartfelt prayer for something that we desperately need. Let's use this opportunity to start again from Parshat Bo. Whatever we said still stands, and whatever we'll be able to say for the rest of the show, we'll just be looking at different things in Parshat Bo. But let's start from the beginning. Bo El Paro, this is not the only time that God said that to Moshe. In fact, there were three times in each of the middle Makkah plague of a three Makkah set. Dom Tzvardeya Kinim, Orov Dever Shchin, Borod Arbe Choshech, Makat Bechorot is the culmination. So the middle of each three set of Makot was a Bo El Paro. The Arbe apparently was very devastating, and Paro was on the brink of letting the people go. You can see his unbelievable stubbornness. In fact, I saw in one of the commentaries that Moshe Rabbeinu was quite concerned by the power of evil that seemed to be so strong in Paro, that one plague after the other, and he still was able to stubbornly refuse to let the people go. And God sort of assured Moshe that it was not Paro on his own, but when he says, when God says to Moshe, Ki ani hichbadti et libo, I am the one who made his heart hard. That opens up a whole other question, which we're not going to explore now, but at least to put Moshe at ease in saying, unbelievable, this Paro guy. So God says, not so unbelievable, because I'm the one that's pulling the strings ultimately, especially in this case. Now, again, without going into it, there's the famous question about, was Paro's free will suspended? And if so, how do we understand that, since a person's supposed to have free will? There are plenty of answers. I've always liked the Ramban's answer, that by toughening Paro, God was not suspending his free will, but was allowing Paro to exercise his free will. Slap a guy, punch a guy, beat a guy down enough, and he's not going to give in out of his free will. He'll give in eventually out of the beatings that he's taken. But by making him tough and stubborn and resistant, then you are not taking away his free will, you are enhancing it. At least that's one way of looking at it. In any event, there's a famous give and take between Paro and Moshe, which I wanted to comment on, and that's Paro says, okay, no problem, mi vami haholachim, who's going? Gonna let you out, who's going? Moshe says, bina'arenu uvizkeinenu nelech, we will go with our youth and our elderly, bivanenu uvivnotenu, with our boys and girls, sons and daughters, bitzonenu uvivkarenu nelech, kichag Hashem lanu. We will go with our cattle and flocks, everything, the whole works. Vayomer Alehem, Paro says to them, etc., etc., meaning dot, 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 Lochein, not so, Lechuna hagivarim, v'ivdu et Hashem, take the adult males and serve God, ki otah atem mevakshim, because that's really what you're asking for. Now, there's a famous echo throughout Jewish history, and I guess world history, that the way to defeat a nation is to somehow cut off its youth from the rest of the nation, let the older people die out, and then you don't have anything to worry about. The danger in the perpetuation of a nation, of a people, of a religion, or whatever, is the fact that the older generation teaches the new generation how to behave, and it's something that they take and they continue and become another link in tradition. So Moshe was expressing, Binarenu uvizkeinenu nelech, this is our way of life. It's a young and old alike kind of religion. where Paro was saying, just go with the adults and leave the children in place. Vayagoresh otam me'et p'nei Paro, and he chased them, or they were chased, from before Paro. Now, I had started earlier talking about mitzvot. We have here what might be a unique set of commands, and to me what makes them unique is the fact that rolled into one is the story of what happened at that night of Yetziat Mitzrayim, and the Korban Pesach of the Egyptian experience compared with what's known as Korban Pesach Lidorot, the one for generations. And it is difficult in the written word, maybe impossible, to distinguish that which becomes a part of the body of law in Shulchan Aruch about the Korban Pesach and what's anecdotal. For example, when the Jews are told that when they slaughter the Korban Pesach, they shall dip an azov, a hyssop plant, in the blood and smear it on their doorposts and lintel. This sounds like a command, along with the others, but we are taught in the oral law that this was a one-shot deal. There are aspects of Korban Pesach that are for all generations. There are other aspects of Korban Pesach Mitzrayim that were for that generation alone. And this blood on the doorpost thing was a one-shot deal. I don't think it's clear in the wording of the written Torah that that is the case, but it certainly is clear when it is spelled out for us in the form of the oral law. And this, to me, makes the important point of the inseparable nature of the written word and the oral law, which we've spoken about many times in the past. And here you see it. Like you can't tell a mitzvah without a scorecard. Does Korban Pesach have to be roasted? Yes, it has to be roasted. Does it have to be eaten with your belt tied and your bags packed? No, it doesn't. Although I might add, by the way, that there are people who reenact the night of the Exodus at their Seder table, and one of the things they do is they have their belts tied and their bags packed and a walking stick in hand, and some actually get up and walk around the table. But that is not part of Pesach Ledorot. Is it eaten together with matzah and maror? Yes, it is. That's in perpetuity. Most of the laws that are spelled out here are for all times, but some of them were only for that generation, only for that one time, the first Pesach in Mitzrayim. Clearly it was different. You did not have a seven-day holiday of Pesach attached to it. You had a one-day kind of experience. But there are other differences, but you cannot tell for certain what belongs to that one-time anecdote and what belongs to the body of laws of Korban Pesach unless you accept the notion of the oral law. Let me jump a little ahead. We have our first introduction to Yom Tov. Specifically, the Torah is talking about the Yom Tov of Pesach, the first day, Uvayom HaRishon Mikra Kodesh, but we generalize to include all of the cycle of the Chagim, the holidays. Mikra Kodesh, it's a holy day, the first. Uvayom HaShvi'i Mikra Kodesh, Yehi Elohim, and the seventh day of Pesach shall also be holy. Kol Malacha Lo Ye'asevohem, no manner of Malacha may be done on them. That makes it very much like Shabbat. However, the Torah qualifies. Ach, Asher Ye'ochel L'chol Nefesh, except for that which will be used to feed people, who levado yeyaseh lachem, only that shall be able to be done. From here we are taught that the malacha of cooking and a few others related to putting food on the table is permitted on Yom Tov, and carrying is permitted on Yom Tov, even when there's no Eruv, and transfer of flame, handling a fire, but not the creation of fire. But it's not that simple. To illustrate what I have in mind, picture the following. You're in your backyard on Yom Tov afternoon, and there is your apricot tree. Make it a plum tree, I think those are more common. And you see a plum fully developed, and it would be nice to pluck it off the tree and eat it. Well, you can't do that on Shabbat, because plucking a fruit from a tree is one of the malachot. You can't do that on Yom Tov either, because malacha is forbidden on Yom Tov. But then you say, wait a minute, the verse says, Ach asher ye'ochel l'chol nefesh. Only that which is necessary for feeding someone, that can be done. And you say, what better illustration of that would be than picking a fruit off the tree? Yet our sages teach us that picking a fruit off a tree on Yom Tov is forbidden. Even if you're hungry, even if you want to eat that plum, even if you have nothing else to eat, you cannot pick a fruit off a tree. Why not? There are reasons. Let's not get into them now. It'll take too long to explain. But there are reasons. Permission to do certain malachot, not all, to bring food to the table has its limits, and picking a fruit is outside that limit, possibly because you could have done it before Yom Tov, and therefore you should have done it before Yom Tov, although that's too simplistic. Now here's another case. I would like to wash my face, and I would like to do it with warm water. Can I take water, put it into a kettle, boil it up on a flame that was already there on the stove from before Yom Tov, and when the water reaches a comfortable temperature, wash my face with it? The answer is, or the question is, well, or the first answer, is of course not, because look at the verse. The verse in the Torah says, you cannot do any malacha except for ochel nefesh, what you need to eat. You're not going to drink the water. If you're asking, can I make hot water for tea? Of course you can. Can I make hot water to wash my face? The answer is yes. We're not talking about electric stuff. That's got a different problem to it. Let's leave that for now. We're talking about the simple illustration that I just gave. Boiling up water, heating up water over a fire that already exists on the stove in order to have warm water to wash your face. You may do. Does not sound like it fits into ochel nefesh. And that's why I reiterate in this example, which is another one of those many examples in the Torah, where the inseparable nature of the written word Torah Shebichtav and the oral law Torah Shebaal Peh is illustrated. Without the guidelines from the oral law, we would have gotten the first 2 points I made wrong. You would think you could pluck a fruit from a tree on Yom Tov. You can't. You would think you're not allowed to boil up water to wash your face. You can. Well, how am I supposed to know that? Torah Shebaal Peh, oral law. Jumping to another point, Korban Pesach is one of only 2 positive commands, as opposed to prohibitions, the non-fulfillment of which, as opposed to the violation of a prohibition, carries with it a penalty of karet, excision, being cut off from the Jewish people. The 2 are Brit Milah, circumcision, and the eating of Korban Pesach. Obviously, we don't eat Korban Pesach today because we don't have a Beit HaMikdash, but we have many commemoratives, but I'm talking about in the ideal situation. What makes Brit Milah and Korban Pesach so different from all other mitzvot asay that they and they alone have the punishment of being cut off from the Jewish people? I would suggest membership rights. Brit Milah, circumcision, is the membership ritual in the Jewish nation. Let me make it clear. When a baby is born Jewish, he's Jewish from birth. Circumcision doesn't make him Jewish, but circumcision enters him into the covenant of Abraham and makes him part and parcel of the Jewish people. Korban Pesach is that statement as well. I hereby want to remain part of the Jewish people. Or someone who violates says, I don't want anything to do with the Jewish people, and the punishment is, okay, you get your wish. There are some interesting links between Brit Milah and Korban Pesach, by the way, one of which is that if you have not been circumcised, you can't eat Korban Pesach, and Orel, even if it's not his fault, is not allowed to eat Korban Pesach. A more obvious common denominator is blood, and there is a pasuk which is said by the kahal present at a brit, same pasuk that we say in the Haggadah, the Haggadah. First, the pasuk is quoted, Vo'e'evor olayich vo'er'ech mitboseset bedomayich, and then the response is, Ve'omar lach bedomayich chayi, Ve'omar lach bedomayich chayi. That is said at a Brit Milah, and that is said as part of the Haggadah service, which commemorates the Korban Pesach. The last two portions of the Sedra of Bo are the two out of the four parshiot in Tfilin. Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe Lemor, Kadesh li chol bechor, Peter kol rechem, Bivnei Yisrael, Ba'adam uva behema lihu. God tells Moshe to sanctify the first issue of the womb. This refers to a human firstborn, the firstborn of a kosher animal, cow, goat, or sheep, and the firstborn of a donkey. Those are not all spelled out here. They're spelled out elsewhere in the Torah. Here it mentions the sanctity of Adam and Behemah from the humans and from the animal world. This topic is elaborated in many places, but even in the second portion, in other words, the last portion in the Sedra, V'haya ki yivyacha Hashem el Eretz Hakna'ani, when God will bring you to Eretz Yisrael, kasher nishba lecha vila avotecha, that God promised you and your ancestors, untana lach, and he will give it to you. Then there is the issue of the firstborn donkey. It makes a passing reference to the Peter Rechem of Peter Sheger Behema, which becomes a korban. I'll try to put all of this together in a moment. I really shouldn't saying it so choppy this way. Anyway, it focuses on the firstborn of a donkey. Let's backtrack. Reference. Three kinds of Bechorim, firstborns. The Kedusha of a Bechor pre-existed the Egyptian experience, but definitely became a focus of the Exodus because of plague number 10, Makat Bechorot, and the Torah speaks of three categories of Bechor. A firstborn to a human. There are details here. Let's go over some of them. We're talking about the first issue of a woman's womb. If it is male, a boy, then it is a bechor. Such a firstborn requires redemption unless the father is a Kohen or a Levi, and unless the mother is a bat Kohen or a bat Levi, and that the birth was natural rather than by cesarean section. A cesarean delivery does not need a pidyon. If the mother had a miscarriage considered to be 40 days from conception or older, then a subsequent natural delivery will not be considered a bechor for pidyon purposes. Statistically, the odds are against a family having a pidyon haben. But it happens. Mirtz Hashem, a week from tomorrow, a week from Friday, we will have a pidyon haben for my latest grandson, Shoham, son of middle daughter Aviva and her husband Ohad. My eldest daughter's first grandson, was also a bechor and had a pidyon, Devir, and I had one as well, a long time ago. Having daughters, I did not have a pidyon to perform, but that's the way it works. The second category of Bechor is a kosher domesticated animal, cow, goat, and sheep. In this case, there is no redemption permitted. The animal born, meaning a male offspring that is the first issue of its mother, is sacred. The owner raises the animal for 30 days in the case of a baby sheep and a baby goat, 50 days in the case of a calf, and then gives it as a gift to the Kohen of his choice. That gift is called Bechor. The Kohen who receives it is required to bring it to the Beit HaMikdash within its first year of life and offer it as a sacrifice known as Bechor, and then eats it with his family, etc., etc., if the animal is blemish-free. If, however, the animal has a blemish, a mum, which invalidates it from the Mizbeach, making it unfit for the altar to be brought as a korban, then it becomes the free and clear property of the Kohen, and he could do whatever he wants, meaning he could slaughter it as regular food and have a barbecue, he can raise it, whatever. It loses its sanctity when it's blemished. However, the blemish cannot be inflicted upon it. It has to be a natural kind of blemish. And there were expert Kohanim in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, and will be Emir Tzashem, who will be able to certify that a particular animal, like a Bechor, is blemished in such a way that it removes its sanctity and allows the Kohen to possess it. The fascinating thing about this particular mitzvah of Bechor, listen again, firstborn of cow, goat, and sheep, male, is sacred. It has to be given as a gift to a Kohen who brings it to the Beit HaMikdash. What's weird about it is this mitzvah applies today. What, you protest? How can it apply today? We don't have a Beit HaMikdash. Fine. Not fine. That's true. But the fact of the matter is, if a Jew owns a female cow, goat, and sheep, pregnant with her first issue, and the baby is a boy, a kid, a lamb, or a calf, that animal is sacred and has to be given as a gift to a Kohen. And the Kohen, if the animal is blemish-free, will have to raise it for its whole life, if that's how long it takes till we get a Mizbeach, never ever benefiting from the animal because it's sacred. So he can't sell its wool, and he can't give the equivalent of pony rides to little kids on its back, and he can't get any benefit, nor can he mistreat it, because there are rules of sacrilege. Therefore, the Shulchan Aruch says, whoa, wait a minute. We know this mitzvah is official, and it applies in our time. We hereby forbid you to fulfill this mitzvah. Nice to say, actually it's sad to say, but how do you do that? The fact of the matter is, the moment the animal, baby animal, is born, it's sacred. Therefore, an owner of the animal has to prepare properly for it. In our time, we're talking about. That means when the animal is still pregnant, the Jew would go to a non-Jew and say, got a deal for you. Give me one shekel, give me a quarter, or whatever, for a tenth of a percent share in my sheep. He says, okay, he's your friend, here's your quarter, here's your shekel, whatever. And he now is a partner. You own 99.9% of the animal. He owns only a tenth of a percent, but you are still technically partners. When an animal is owned jointly by Jew and non-Jew, there is no sanctity of Bechor. That means when the female sheep, the ewe, gives birth, even if it's a male, there is no sanctity. Therefore, the owner is spared having to give this to a Kohen, and the Kohen is spared having to raise this animal until we have a Beit HaMikdash, or until it would have a blemish. It is sad, if you think about it, that Shulchan Aruch, our code of laws, which is supposed to tell us how to keep mitzvot and which things to do and which things we're not allowed to do, has to tell us, unfortunately, here's a mitzvah, a fine, upstanding mitzvah, don't do it, get out of it, because it has its pitfalls. In any event, let's move on to the third category of Bechor, the firstborn of a donkey. The firstborn of a donkey is not sacred in the sense that the cow, goat, and sheep would be. A donkey is not a kosher animal. A donkey is not fit for the altar. But the owner of the donkey is not allowed to benefit from it until he redeems it. He redeems it by a ceremony in which he gives a sheep or the monetary value of a sheep as a gift to a kohen. No kedusha, no sanctity here. He just goes through the ceremony. I imagine if the kohen says, you know, I'll take the cash, you could keep your sheep, then it'll work out that way. And only after pidyon peter chamor, the redemption of a firstborn donkey, does the donkey owner have the permission now to raise the donkey and do with it whatever people do with donkeys they raise. Now, let's say we're dealing with a Jewish owner of a female donkey, pregnant with her first offspring, and he says to himself, I learned, or I listened to Torah Tidbits audio, and I know that if there is joint ownership in the mother animal between a Jew and a non-Jew, then there is no status of Bechor that follows. So what I'm going to do with my pregnant donkey is go to a non-Jewish friend of mine, say, give me a quarter for a 0.1%. Those numbers, by the way, are not significant. I'm just using it as an example. Give me a quarter, and you will become a partner in my female donkey. Then the donkey gives birth, and it's a male. And the guy, the owner, has saved himself however much a sheep costs on the open market. Then he goes to his non-Jewish friend. He buys back his 0.1% share, decides to be gracious about it, and gives him a $0.50 or a 2 shekel for it. And he saved himself several hundred shekel or whatever. I have no idea what a sheep costs. First question is that, does it work? The answer is yes, it does. Shulchan Aruch says, if you read the last chapter carefully, you will see that you could do that ownership thing and bypass the status of Bechor. When it was a cow, goat, or a sheep, we told you to do it. We commanded you, by rabbinic authority, to get out of the mitzvah of Bechor, of a cow, goat, and sheep, because it's problematic. The animal is sacred, and in order to finish the process, you really need a Beit HaMikdash, which we don't currently have. However, says the Shulchan Aruch, when it comes to a peter chamor, a firstborn donkey, there is no sanctity. There is no thing that is involved with the Beit HaMikdash. Therefore, it is a fine, upstanding, albeit rare, mitzvah that applies today. And the Shulchan Aruch says, don't get out of it. Do the mitzvah. I would emphasize something at this point. If you don't listen to the Shulchan Aruch, and you do go into partnership with a non-Jew token for the mother donkey before the baby is born, then you have successfully bypassed the status of Bechor, and you have saved yourself however much a sheep costs. The donkey is no less whatever it is because you didn't listen to the Shulchan Aruch. There's no penalty for it. The donkey is yours free and clear like it would have been anyway. but you didn't do the proper thing. And that counts for something as well. In other words, there are many, many commands that if we violate them or don't fulfill them, then a person is liable to a punishment. Here, I wouldn't say that unless you want to say that he's accountable to God for having disregarded the proper procedure and having not gone through Pidyon Peter Chamor, but rather than circumvent. But I want to make it clear. If a person is the sole owner, a Jew is the sole owner of the mother donkey, and the offspring is born and it's male, and he does not go through Pidyon Peter Chamor, nor does he choose its alternative, which is less favorable, and that is the destruction of the baby donkey, but instead he just doesn't say anything to anybody or makes an excuse like was a cesarean delivery or the mother donkey had previous births or miscarriages, could have been, and he does not redeem it, then he is in serious violation if he uses that baby donkey for his own purposes. But if he got out of it limafreya, in other words, before the baby donkey was born, he's free, except that he didn't do a mitzvah like he was supposed to. There's a qualitative difference there, and I hope you get the point. Let's wrap up this week's Torah Tidbits audio with another song. I'll wish you in advance a Shabbat Shalom and Lehishtameah, and I hope you enjoy the whole show, all of its music, all of its Divrei Torah, and we'll finish with a piece of music, a track from a CD. I unfortunately have it listed as untitled. A lot of them come in like that. Always reminds me of one of my favorite cartoons because it so much exemplifies my filing system. Wall-to-wall, floor-to-ceiling file drawers. Dozens and dozens of them. Let's say 8 going up and 12 going across. 96 file drawers. High up in the upper left-hand corner is a drawer marked A to Z. All the rest are marked miscellaneous. So when I take CDs and record them on my computer for inserting into shows, sometimes they come in with a name and sometimes they come in as untitled and I forget to put the name. Here's a nice song. Enjoy it. One of these days I'll get more organized and tell you what it is. So once again, I will say Shabbat Shalom and Lehishtameah.
לבקש רחמים וסימן שיבוא כמו הגשם כשירד ויתן בי חיים לעייף לצמא כמו בקסם עוד כוכב שצונח מעל ואני מבקש משאלות תן שלום, תן חיים, תן ברכה קח את החרב מהאדמות אלוקים, תן רחמים, כן ותקווה, תן לחיים, כן אל אדיר, רחמים אדם בחיים מחייך ופתאום הוא עצוב לא שואל שאלות מאמין שהכל מלמעלה כתוב רק אתה שתושיע אין למי לפנות לבקש רחמים רק אתה שתציל אותי מכל השטויות כשהייתי תמיד אלוקים, תן רחמים, כן ותקווה, תן לחיים, כן שבי נגמר כל הכל